she said with a smile. Why not? I was going to ask you the same thing, Jack. I want to get married someday. Just need to find the right woman who has the time for a relationship. Do you have the time for one? Ouch. I guess I'm kind of busy these days. And yet, here you are, in the middle of Bosnia. Not so bad, is it? Not bad at all. I'm curious. Tell me about this right woman of yours. Jack sat up. This is getting interesting. Smart is the most important attribute, after character. Beautiful is nice, but that comes from within. And let's see. How about transparent? Transparent? That's terrible, she joked. Why? A girl likes to keep a little bit of mystery about her. Don't men find that more interesting? Depends on what the mystery is, I guess. What about you? Who is your Mr. Right? That's easy. A man who loves his family. An honorable man. A man who works hard and provides for the ones he loves. She shot him a glance. And a man who doesn't ask too many questions. Well, I guess that takes me out of the running, especially since I have one more. Do you want kids? As many as possible. Me too. Or four, whichever is less. She laughed. You have brothers and sisters? Two sisters and a brother. The older sister is a neurosurgeon and a brainiac like my mom. And your father works for the government. A high-level bureaucrat, you said. That's what he'd call it for sure. It's kind of an executive position. And your parents are still married. A long time. They're even in love. How romantic. And rare, I think. It's a miracle. And you admire them. More than you know. That's nice. And just like that, Jack felt the door shut. They were definitely connecting. But something happened. Did he say something wrong? No, he hadn't. But for whatever reason, she wasn't going to let this thing go any further. Jack couldn't blame her. He was just another American tourist who'd be moving on in another day or two. And what was he thinking? There wasn't any way this thing was going to work between the two of them. He was grateful she'd shut this conversation down. They rode along in a sad, comfortable silence for a while, Jack's mind turning to the world outside the windshield. At around noon, Aida finally asked, "Getting hungry?" "Yeah, sure." Jack was staring out of his window. Down below, the Neretva River rolled wide and slow between sloping, tree-covered hills. "I know a place. You're the tour guide." A few minutes later, Aida pulled off the two-lane asphalt and onto a dirt road threading down through the pines and toward the river. 100 feet later, a chain barrier blocked the way down farther. She put the van in park, hopped out, and unlocked the chain, then crawled back into the driver's seat and continued on. A few moments later, they entered a secluded clearing on the banks of the river, sparkling in the warm sunshine. Aida killed the engine. "This place you know must deliver," Jack said as he opened his door. "I brought the little picnic for us. Hope you don't mind." She opened the back hatch and pulled a blanket off a small ice chest hidden beneath it. An ice chest. Great. She opened the ice chest. Bottles of frosty cold beer jutted out of the ice. "It's Serievska brand. Hope you like it." Jack pulled one out. "Know it well. Good choice." "Thank you." Aida grabbed the blanket and a basket. "Follow me." They set up beside the river in the leafy shade of a paper mulberry tree. She'd put together a spread of sandwiches, a Bosnian version of Greek salad and fruit, and, of course, the beer. They ate mostly in silence, with a few stolen glances between bites and heaping servings of Jack's praise for the delicious food. The cold beer tasted great in the gathering heat, and the whispering river looked cool and inviting. Aida finished her meal and her beer and stood. I'm going in. She sauntered down to the water's edge, knowing that Jack's eyes were tracking her every movement. She stared at the light dappling on the river's surface for a moment before lifting off her blouse and dropping it by her feet. She kicked off her shoes and slipped off her yoga pants. Jack's eyes drank in the curves of her body, a silhouette against the sunlight dancing on the water. A lacy bra and panties weren't much of a bathing suit, but that was fine by him. Aida reached behind her back and unhooked her bra, slipped the straps off her shoulders and turned around, then let the bra fall away. Will you be joining me, Jack? Yeah. They played and swam in the river, both naked as the day God made them. But Aida's play turned to something else altogether when Jack carried her back to the blanket and laid her down. And Emir watched it all through his binoculars from high on the road, his eyes blurred with bitter tears. Chapter 47. Rome. The Hendley Associates Gulfstream jet was parked near a hangar on the far side of the General Aviation Terminal at Ciampino Airport, smaller and more convenient than Leonardo da Vinci. By special arrangement, Ciampino operated 24/7 for Hendley aircraft, a critical advantage for short-notice missions like theirs. It was also closer to the city where Dom, Adara, and Midas were chasing down leads on Elena Iliescu and the Iron Syndicate, which presumably employed her. Trieste had been a bust, and the closest thing to a thread of possible connection between her and the mysterious organization had led them here. Gavin Beery tracked down a cell phone number that had received a call from Iliescu's phone the night before she drove to Trieste. The man's name was Renzo Castelletti, born in Florence, but lately shuttling quite frequently among Rome, Trieste, and Vienna. At first, they assumed the man was Iliescu's accomplice in the attack on Jack, running intel or interference. But a more thorough analysis of Castelletti's phone records indicated something else. He was either a traveling gynecologist doing international house calls or, as Gavin reported breathlessly, an honest-to-goodness authentic Italian gigolo, judging by the disproportionate number of women he spoke to and visited with on a regular basis. Castelletti's cell phone was currently pinging off a cell tower near Rome's Westin Excelsior Hotel. Gavin hadn't been given permission by Jerry to break into any private cell phones of people who weren't demonstrably guilty of any crime, but he was allowed to build an algorithm that allowed him to vacuum up cell tower data and match it to simultaneous cell phone usage. When two parties were both pinging on cell towers at the same time, Gavin's second algorithm sorted for length of phone call. When two calls lasted for the same exact length of time, he presumed they were speaking with each other. Gavin's magic math tricks, as Dom referred to them, led the team to the Westin Excelsior, where they would be arriving soon. After refueling and inspecting the plane earlier, Lisanne sent the two pilots to a local hotel with a Hendley Associates account. She opted to stay behind for a few more hours, taking advantage of the onboard computer and satellite link. She needed to catch up on her paperwork and check for the necessary documentation and other arrangements for the three cities where Gavin thought they would be heading after Vienna, their destination tomorrow. Lost in her work, she was completely unaware of the airport customs officer standing at the foot of the stairs. "Mi scusi," he called up. Lisanne glanced up from her work, a little rattled by the voice. But when she saw the young, handsome Italian in his crisp new uniform and armed only with a clipboard, she relaxed. "Yes. I need to inspect your plane." The officer stood in the cabin doorway now, flashing a disarming smile. If she had been in a cozy little piano bar, Lisanne would have been flattered, tempted even. But she was on duty. "We were cleared this morning." Si. But my boss, he says take another look. I'm sorry. He grinned and shrugged while flashing his hands, a gesture of infinite regret but also official inevitability. He was awfully handsome. What would it hurt? She relented. Knock yourself out. Grazie. The man stepped in, consulting his clipboard. He pointed at the cockpit. Okay? Don't touch anything. Of course. Just a formality. Lisanne turned back to her workstation. She sniffed the air. Whatever sweet, leathery cologne he was wearing was having its desired effect. She stole a sidelong glance at him. She was on duty, but she wasn't dead. He cut a dashing figure in his uniform for sure, from the top of his high-peaked cap to the bottom of his shiny patent leather shoes. His shoes. The wrong shoes. Lisanne drew her Sig Sauer Micro 9mm from the holster beneath the table, but she was too late. The man batted the pistol out of her hand and lunged for her throat. She let him in close enough to throw a fierce uppercut into his clenched jaw. It wasn't enough. His eyes watered as he grunted, but his powerful hands still found her neck. She couldn't breathe, let alone scream, as his weight bore down on her, pinning her against the desk. She reached behind, her hands desperately searching for something. Anything! She jammed the scissors into his left ear. He screamed in agony and clutched at his wound, releasing her. She threw a hard elbow into his face, toppling him backward. She turned and ran toward the back of the cabin, diving to the floor where she thought her weapon had clattered to a halt beneath one of the seats. She reached back until she finally wrapped her hand around the pistol's walnut-grained handle, then rolled onto her back into the aisle, flipping the thumb safety to fire. But her bladed sights were pointed at empty space. The Iron Syndicate assassin was gone. What about the others? She had to warn them. She grabbed her phone and punched Dom's number. No answer. Near Tientiste, Republika Srpska, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Slowly, brothers. Carefully. The Syrian captain kept a wary eye on the two big Bosniaks muscling up the first 200-pound missile into the BM-21 Grad launch tube. The four spring-loaded stabilizer fins were strapped against the fuselage so that the missile could fit inside the tube. But as soon as the rocket motor fired, the straps were burnt away, and the fins deployed upon exiting the tube. A simple, analog solution to a complex problem. Russian design genius at its practical best. Burkic could hardly contain his excitement watching the first missile loading, a bullet being chambered into an assassin's 40-round revolver. This was the first step on a journey that would lead to the end of the humiliation of his god and his people, first in Europe and then throughout the world. A journey Burkic would take without Red Wing's permission, because Red Wing was only an arrow in the quiver of the Almighty, whose plans were never thwarted. True to his word to Red Wing so many years ago, Tariq Burkic, then known as Rizvan Sadaev, remained in Bosnia after the war ended, married a local Bosniak woman, and became a citizen of the Republic of Bosnia and Herzegovina, biding his time until the next opportunity to strike. And that time was now. When Red Wing contacted him with the plan to initiate a civil war to defeat the unity referendum, Burkic gladly accepted, on condition that Red Wing would give him access to his smuggling routes, so that guns, drugs, and jihadi fighters could be brought into the region and transported farther north into Europe as needed. Causing a civil war through false flag operations was a tried-and-true tactic of governments everywhere. Red Wing's own government had done it successfully in Syria only recently. There was no question that Red Wing's plan would work. But to what end? A civil war would end in the partition of Bosnia, itself a creation of the Western powers, designed to keep Muslims in the region under control. Muslims across the Balkans could form a new, larger Islamic state in the heart of Europe. But what would happen then? At best, neutralization by NATO and Russia, fearing the contagion of Muslim self-governance across the Eurasian continent. Or worse, the extermination of Muslims altogether. It wasn't enough for Bosniaks to free themselves, or for Muslims in the Balkans to unite. Red Wing's government promised to protect them, but it was clear that his government's ultimate goal was to control them. The only way to protect Muslims from the two great power blocs was to destroy those blocs. But how? Even now, NATO and Russia were killing brothers all over the planet. Fundamentalist Islam, the kind Berkich practiced, was on the run. Berkich knew that only NATO and Russia were strong enough to stop the other. His plan would result in a war between NATO and Russia, and such a war would result in the downfall of Red Wing's government as well. The destruction of the great powers would pave the way for true Islam to take leadership of Europe first, and then of the world, and ultimately, the world to come. Inshallah. Rome. The woman in the fifth-story corner window across the street from the Westin Excelsior had eyes on Dom, Adara, and Midas as they entered the hotel. She was on the phone with her contact in Vienna. "Any minute now," she said, and smiled. Dom, Adara, and Midas strolled through the hotel like they owned the place, knowing full well that the crowded lobby was under constant surveillance by the ubiquitous security cameras, tastefully concealed in the ceilings and corners throughout the building. That knowledge was strangely comforting to a team that didn't want to be discovered, because it was that security system that would enable them to complete their mission tonight. Gavin's advanced remote search of the hotel security system 2 hours earlier had paved the way for them in two important ways. First, 30 minutes before the team entered the hotel, Gavin spoofed the live camera feed, replaying footage from 2 hours prior. No one casually monitoring the system would notice anything but the usual anonymous traffic of guests and hotel employees circulating throughout the hotel. Nothing live was currently being shown or recorded, including the movements of Dom, Adara, and Midas. The second way the hotel's own security system aided their efforts tonight was in locating their target. Hacking past the hotel's civilian-grade firewall was a piece of cake for the wily IT genius. With a picture of Renzo Castelletti in hand, Gavin's search algorithm easily traced the Florentine steps from the lobby to the elevators, and finally to room number 3407, where he was greeted by the registered guest, a large and welcoming middle-aged real estate broker from Franklin, Tennessee. With that, it was simple enough for Gavin to secure the computer guest check-in file and recover the RFID chip code embedded in the woman's room card. He then sent that code to a MyFair Pagoda 2 13.56 MHz RFID reader-writer device, stored for just such a purpose on the Hendley Associates Gulfstream. Adara cloned 3 hotel key cards for room 3407 and passed out 2 to Dom and Midas before heading to the hotel. The 3 of them exited the elevator on the 3rd floor. The hallway was empty. Midas dialed the Florentine's cell number lifted from Elena's phone address book and proceeded to walk past 3407 just as Castelletti's phone rang. That was all the confirmation they needed that he was still in there. They doubled back and approached the room. Muffled groans and shrieks rumbled behind the heavy door. Midas nodded to the room service tray on the floor next to the door, littered with 3 drained bottles of Colalto Prosecco Brut, a heaping mound of shocked oyster shells, and a couple empty tins of Iranian caviar. "They're not doing Bible study in there," Midas whispered in his comms. "I hope you kids don't blush easily." Checking to make sure the hallway was still clear, they pulled on ski masks and gloves and pulled their weapons, then keyed the door and rushed in as quietly as possible, heading for the bedroom, expecting total surprise and no resistance. They were half right. Neither Castelletti nor the woman offered any resistance. They couldn't. Their naked corpses lay tangled in the blood-soaked sheets, their throats slit ear to ear. The fat woman's wrists and ankles were tied by silken cords to the bedposts. a silver and jeweled Venetian Carnival cat mask still fixed to her face. Adding to the macabre surrealism of the moment was the porn movie groaning and shrieking in Dolby Digital 5.1 surround sound on the bedroom's widescreen television. Surprise. Their only lead to Elena Iliescu was gone. Now what? Adara asked. Dom nodded toward the door. We get the hell out of here. Fast. As soon as they cleared the lobby, Dom called Lisanne. He filled her in on the carnage they had found and the loss of Castelletti, their only lead. Just glad you're okay, was all she said. I was about to call in the cavalry. Dom and the others had silenced their cell phones for the op. She told Dom about the syndicate hitter and the stainless steel earache she had given him. You okay? I'm fine, the former combat medic said. I'm keeping his hat for a souvenir. On the drive back to the hangar, the four of them discussed options on speakerphone. The attack on Lisanne and the elimination of the Florentine meant they were on the right path. The only question now was, stay put and try and flush the syndicate out, or move on? The syndicate must have known that Lisanne had filed the flight plan for Vienna. Trying to kill her and possibly destroy the plane meant the syndicate didn't want them going there. Staying put was also inviting another attack, and probably not by an unarmed singleton. So, Vienna it was. Chapter 48. Mostar, Bosnia and Herzegovina. After sating themselves on the riverbank, Jack and Aida packed up and continued the drive along the winding road. They paid more attention to each other than to the local scenery, Aida pointing out less and less until they reached Mostar, jammed with spectators for the Red Bull cliff diving competition from the city's fabled bridge, famous for local talent diving off it for cash tips from tourists. Mostar was crowded and hot, and after a quick walking tour of the old town and a gander at the bridge jumpers, they headed to a 4-star hotel for a light dinner and even hotter sex than before. They woke up famished and attacked an amazing breakfast buffet of local meats, cheeses, specialty dishes, and just about anything sweet Jack could think of, along with strong black coffee and orange juice. Aida devoured 2 helpings of ratatouille, not Jack's idea of a breakfast dish. She listed the sights they could see as they left Mostar, including the 16th-century dervish tekke, a monastery built into the side of a cliff, and the Catholic pilgrimage city of Medjugorje, where the appearance of the Virgin Mary to 6 Herzegovinian children in 1981 was commemorated. She then began describing the windy Vjetranica cave, one of the largest in Europe. But Jack hardly heard a word. He just fell deeper into her stunning blue eyes. He grabbed her by the hand, tossed the desk clerk an extra 20-euro note for a late checkout, and took her back to their room. They arrived in Dubrovnik, Croatia, in the early afternoon. Situated on the coast of the dazzling blue Adriatic, the gleaming white medieval city glowed beneath the sun. It reminded Jack of Minas Tirith from the Lord of the Rings movies. The only problem was that Gandalf, Jerry, had already sent him 2 anxious texts. Where the hell are you? Problem? Aida asked. Just my boss. Wants me to cut my vacation short. You Americans work too hard. Jack texted back. I'm in Dubrovnik. Perfect weather. 4 more days, guaranteed. Jerry wrote back. The girl? Yep. Would I like her? Yep. Your dad? Yep. Your mother? Yep, times 2. Since nothing confirmed on our end regarding your situation, and against my better judgment, I'll give you 4 more days. But that's it. Check in daily and stay alert. Understood? Understood. All good? Aida smiled hopefully. All good. Except for the fact there might be a secret international criminal syndicate trying to murder him. But he dismissed it. If there was a real problem, Jerry would have told him. The tourist traffic was bumper to bumper across the 1,700-foot Franjo Tudjman Bridge, an ultra-modern steel-cabled structure featuring a giant A-shaped pylon, a real contrast to the fitted ancient stones of the old town. They finally made their way to La Pade, one of the newer suburbs of the city, where Aida said she owned an apartment. She pulled up to a small warehouse, its steel door shut. She called the number on her phone, and a moment later the steel door was rolled open by a Croatian man in grease-stained gray coveralls. His eyes narrowed at the sight of Jack, but he didn't say a word as Aida pulled in and the garage door closed behind them. "This will just take a minute," Aida said as she got out. "No problem." Jack watched Aida and the Croatian wander over to a pallet stacked with cardboard boxes stamped in Croatian he couldn't read, but with medical symbols he recognized, including the staff of Asclepius. Aida had told him the reason she needed to come to Dubrovnik was to pick up some medical supplies. He assumed it would be at a pharmacy or a hospital, not an unmarked warehouse in a semi-suburban neighborhood. He watched Aida chatting it up with the expressionless Croatian, and what little he could hear of it was in a language he didn't speak. The man kept his heavy hands shoved into the pockets of his coveralls, his eyes shifting back and forth between Aida and Jack. Aida turned around once or twice, offering Jack a wide smile while she kept speaking, and Jack returned it, but he got the sense the conversation was a little more heated than Aida was letting on. Finally, the Croatian nodded. Aida pulled out cash from her pocket and counted off a number of bills that Jack couldn't make out. Apparently it was enough. The stone-faced Croatian finally smiled and took the cash. Aida came back over to the van and stuck her head in the window. "Ready to go? Everything okay?" "Sure. We'll just leave the van here. Parking on the street is no good at my place. It's not far."
"Works for me."
They pulled their two-wheeled bags out of the back of the van as the Croatian rolled up the steel door again, shutting it behind them as they started up the steep concrete hill toward her apartment.
"So those were the medical supplies you came for?"
"Yes."
"There was a problem, though."
"Not a problem, a misunderstanding. All good now."
The diesel engine of a giant silver Mercedes tour bus roared in their ears as it passed by. Several white-haired tourists stared blankly at them out of their smoke-tinted windows. The hill got steeper as they walked. It reminded Jack of a summer he had spent in San Francisco. The air here on the coast was cooler, and there was a slight breeze. They passed several staircases climbing up to homes and apartments built on the hills ascending from the street. Jack was glad he wasn't on crutches or in a wheelchair living in this city.
"So I'm curious. Why drive all the way to pick up the meds? Wouldn't it be cheaper to order them by mail? Fly them in?"
"Sadly, it's cheaper to do it this way. The clinic can't afford the... how do you Americans say it? The five-finger discount?"
"You're worried about stuff getting stolen?"
"Sometimes high-value cargo gets inspected by customs agents, and things disappear. And then there is the red tape, which magically disappears once a handful of cash appears. Or sometimes things get impounded and the shipment is never seen again."
"So, basically you're smuggling."
"Well, yes. I suppose you could call it that."
"Isn't that illegal?"
Aida tilted her head.
"Yes, of course. But it was illegal to smuggle black slaves on the Underground Railroad too, wasn't it? Why should I let corrupt and greedy politicians rob poor refugees of the medicines they need?
Why expect that kind of thing in the Third World? Not Europe."
Aida stopped in her tracks, fighting a smile.
"Oh, Jack, are you really so naive? Do you think such things don't happen all over Europe? And in your country as well?"
"What do you mean?" How do you suppose so many billions of dollars worth of drugs and smuggled people and guns and everything else illegal gets into your country every year? Do you think it could be done without bribing judges and mayors? Do you think there are no American border guards and customs officers on the payrolls of the Mexican mafia? Jack should have known better. His grandfather was a Baltimore police detective, and Jack had heard stories over the years of all manner of big city corruption and crime. He just thought, or rather hoped, those days were long past in his country. They trudged along like Sherpas for another 100 yards, and Aida stopped again. "We're here." Jack glanced up the staircase. He'd skied on Colorado mountain slopes that weren't as steep. Aida laughed, collapsing her telescoping bag handle. "If it's too much for you, I'll carry your bag." Jack collapsed his handle too and snatched up her bag. "I've got the bags. Start climbing, Sir Edmund." 77 steps later, they made a sharp left turn onto a landing, and then another right, and up yet another 27 steps through a vine-covered archway gate. Aida pulled out a set of keys and opened the door on her front porch. The apartment was small but clean, decorated with local art pieces, and full of comfortable and stylish furniture. Best of all, from her front porch was a view of the Adriatic Sea. A cruise ship was passing by, trailing a small wake, heading south for the old town. "Can I get you something to drink before we leave? Water? Beer?" "Leave?" Jack was surprisingly exhausted from the arduous climb. Nearly 2 weeks without a serious workout and overindulging in rich food and carb-loaded beer hadn't exactly enhanced his physical conditioning. "We're going to tour the old town. It's beautiful this time of day. And then I know a great place for dinner." Chapter 49. Jack and Aida took a Dubrovnik city bus to the Pilaganta in the old town and crossed over the moat beneath the iron bars of the portcullis, just like in an old Hollywood movie. They climbed up the stone stairs beyond the gate and paid for their tickets for the wall walk, and they strolled the perimeter of the ancient port citadel. The wide towering walls provided picture-perfect glimpses of the glassy Adriatic Sea, the sturdy St. Lawrence Fortress just beyond the western wall, and the city's old battlements, Croatian flags snapping in the breeze. Tour boats, yachts, and cruise liners were at their slips or heading out, as rental kayaks bobbed up and down near the walls. Directly below, Jack saw the smooth, tightly fitted stones of the city streets crowded with international tourists, Renaissance-era churches, and innumerable shops. He could definitely feel the Venetian influence on the architecture. Aida explained that the Serbs bombarded the city at the beginning of the war and pointed out the original faded red roof tiles and then the newer, brighter ones that had been replaced after the shelling finally stopped. How long was the siege here? It lasted from October 1991 until May 1992. 8 months. The casualties must have been terrible. Less than 100 civilian deaths and less than 200 military killed. She added dismissively, "That was their war." They descended the wall into the city and she dragged him through the crowds to a few of her favorite shops, but she could tell Jack was less than interested. "Something wrong, Jack? I noticed a lot of Game of Thrones merchandise in the windows. They shoot some of the series in Dubrovnik. You can even take Game of Thrones-themed tours if you want." "Don't get me wrong. The city is beautiful. But some of it feels like a Renaissance version of a shopping mall." "Yes, I suppose you're right. But shopping is what tourists do, isn't it? And Dubrovnik is all about tourists." "I guess I'm just not a big shopper." "Hungry?" "Starving. Where's that restaurant you were talking about?" Aida smiled. They raced back to her place and messed up her bedsheets with rigor before she ordered up a hand-tossed pizza from a local restaurant while Jack opened a bottle of fine Croatian red wine. This was definitely Jack's favorite restaurant in Dubrovnik, but he wouldn't be posting about it on TripAdvisor. While Jack and Aida feasted on their delivered pizza and red wine, the grease-stained Croatian bolted shut the last case of handguns in the secret compartment wedged into the undercarriage of the Happy Times tour van. He then wiped on a couple handfuls of manufactured road grime to camouflage the compartment, just in case an honest cop decided to put a mirror to the undercarriage at the border crossing. He slid out from underneath and dusted himself off, satisfied that the medicines were as well hidden as the guns. The van was ready to go now. Time to find something to eat.
Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Cenk Yılmaz, an ethnic Turk, was happy. The room he supervised was working exactly as he had designed it, humming with the murmur of excited young voices sharing ideas and the rapid clicking of computer keyboards. As a former Facebook employee with contacts still working in Menlo Park, Yılmaz possessed an intimate working knowledge of the complex algorithms that drove social media trends across all the major platforms. He'd personally trained each of the 15 men and 3 women working this evening, pushing out the next social media campaign he'd designed. By his calculation, within hours, 400,000 Bosniaks would be raging at their computers and smartphones over the Muslim wedding massacre. The talent in the room was divided into 2 distinct parts, the humans and the bots. Over the past 2 years, Yılmaz had used his human engineers to create dozens of fake but prominent social media accounts of quote-unquote ordinary Croats, Serbs, and Muslims, primarily on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and popular Bosnian blogging sites. Several of the fake accounts had garnered tens of thousands of devoted followers across the country and throughout the region in both the Serbo-Croatian and English languages. No matter how hard the coding wizards in Silicon Valley tried, nobody had yet come up with software that could simulate the authentic engagement of actual human minds. These human-orchestrated accounts were the platforms where Yılmaz's important messages were first deployed. Any message put on them would instantly touch thousands. But in order to get those messages to go viral and reach hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people with sudden impact, his other non-human team jumped into action. Yılmaz understood better than most the Achilles heel of all social media platforms. They were their own worst enemy. Social media platforms were designed for the sole purpose of drawing as many eyeballs as possible to their sites in order to sell ads to advertisers. Social media platform algorithms were always on the lookout for hot new trending topics and looking to point their consumers to those same hot trends and in turn make those pages even hotter. The more popular the trend, the more eyeballs on the page, and the more advertising money the platform could make. The challenge for any blogger or poster was to find a way to get their blog or post trending. Technicians like Yılmaz knew the answer. Fake it. Yılmaz's cadre of talented software programmers designed and deployed social media bots. These bots, automated software programs, amplified each human post, like, and tweet with thousands of new software-generated likes, posts, and tweets, along with retweets and reposts, making it appear as if an avalanche of interest and engagement was coalescing around the original human content. Suddenly, hot trends manufactured by Yılmaz and his team became hotter and hotter as more and more people became aware of them, fueled by the social media platform's own search algorithms. This created an exponential increase in social media attention for any news item Yılmaz was directed to exploit. He further capitalized on the situation by deploying commercially available analytical tools, such as BuzzSumo and Dataminer, which identified and even contributed to emerging social media trends. Using the carefully edited photos and videos he'd received from the Visegrad wedding massacre, Yılmaz deployed both his humans and his bots to begin a campaign to manufacture Muslim outrage, first in Bosnia and then, he hoped, throughout the Muslim communities of Europe and eventually the world. The first Facebook post that started gaining viral traction ended with the hashtag Remember Srebrenica. His main concern was that companies like Facebook had recently begun to take precautions against the governments and criminal organizations corrupting and hijacking their algorithms. But Silicon Valley paid scant attention to Bosnia and didn't deploy enough software-generated assets in Serbo-Croatia for shadow banning or any other defensive measures to be of any concern. If Yılmaz was wrong, he'd know soon enough. But he hoped his phone call to his employer would be a pleasant one. Judging by the gruesome massacre images now being pushed out onto the internet, Yılmaz understood the brutal consequences of failure for him and his team. Red Wing was not a forgiving person. Chapter 50. Near Blagaj, Bosnia and Herzegovina. The one place Jack wished he had seen on the way out to Dubrovnik was the Dervish Tekija overlooking the Bruna River. So on their return leg, they left Dubrovnik in time to arrive at about noon to tour the 16th century cliffside monastery, and then to sample the special trout at the nearby riverside restaurant. That left them enough time to get back to Sarajevo before dark if they kept moving. A kilometer south of Blagaj, Aida and Jack spotted a Bosnian policeman standing in the road behind his unmarked car with a sign that read Granica Inspekcija and waving a red flashlight baton, indicating where they should exit the road. My Bosnian isn't so good, but that looks like a customs inspection. Not a problem, Aida said. Open the glove box, please. Jack opened it and saw a folded stack of Bosnian marks in a money clip. He handed it to her as she slowed to a stop. She peeled off a large bill as she rolled down her window and spoke to him in their native tongue. But neither the sweet talk nor the cash had the desired effect, and the sour-faced policeman simply shook his head and pointed the baton in the direction of the exit. Aida gave up, muttering under her breath, and headed down the dirt incline. "So maybe it is a problem," Jack said. For a brief moment, he wondered if this might have been the iron syndicate hit Jerry had warned him about. She shook her head. More money, that's all. They're all greedy bastards. She seemed confident enough, so Jack relaxed. The van kicked up dust as it rapidly descended toward the river, far below the highway above and out of sight of any passing traffic. Jack turned around and saw the unmarked police vehicle following them down the same dirt path in their cloud of dust. Not a good sign. Two masked policemen in tactical gear stood down by the river where the dirt road ended. The tall one had a Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine gun on a sling. The shorter carried only a pistol on his hip. He pointed to a spot just in front of him, indicating where Aida should park the van. "This doesn't look friendly," Jack said, wishing like hell he had his Glock 19 with him. "Just scare tactics. No worries. Unless these are hitters for the Iron Syndicate." As Aida slipped the van into park, the tall officer crossed over to Jack's side and the short one approached Aida's window. The other police car pulled up behind the van, blocking their escape route, Jack noted, wondering if Aida was thinking about it. The short cop yanked Aida's door open and jerked his head, indicating she should get out. The tall cop did the same on Jack's side, and the four of them walked to the back of the van, where the third cop was already standing. The short cop barked a command and Aida opened the van's rear doors. He glanced inside. Nothing but two pieces of luggage and a couple cardboard boxes. He ripped them open and found used baby clothes, which he flung out piece by piece like he was searching for something. Nothing. He tossed the empty boxes back into the van, frustrated. The short cop turned back to Aida, firing questions at her in Bosanski, starting with her name, which she repeated. The short cop's voice got more heated with each one-word answer Aida gave. Da or ne? Yes or no? Jack kept his eye on the other two cops, and their hands touching their weapons. Their eyes shifted back and forth between Aida and him. Something was going down.
Finally, the short cop pulled a photograph from his vest pocket and showed it to Aida. He asked, Dalisnash Tarika Birkitsa? Do you know Tariq Birkic?
Da. On he mahanichar. Ponekad radi zamene.
Yes. He's a mechanic. He works for me sometimes. The short cop nodded, satisfied with her answer. He shifted his gaze over to Jack. He asked Aida a question in her language. Aida translated for Jack.
He wants to know who you are.
Tell him I'm nobody.
He won't like that answer. He wants to know your name.
Jack hesitated. But what choice did he have at this point? Jack Ryan. The cop's eyes shifted to his taller partner standing beside Jack. They exchanged a few words. He turned back to Jack and stuck out a gloved palm.
Pasosh. He wants to see your passport, Jack.
Yeah, I figured. Jack reached for his back pocket. Two pistols snapped up, pointing at his head. Hey, fellas. Just doing what the man asked. He handed the short cop his passport. The cop flipped it open, read it, handed it to the tall cop, who read it too. He nodded at his short partner and pocketed it. I need that back, Jack said. It's private property. The short cop told Aida to keep translating. She did.
He says your name is familiar.
It's a pretty common name where I come from. He wants to know what you're doing in Bosnia. I'm a tourist.
How do you know this woman?
She's my tour guide. He nodded at the Happy Times van. We're heading back to Sarajevo.
Where did you come from?
Dubrovnik.
What did you do there?
Toured the city.
Anything else?
Jack wanted to say something about the unbelievable sex he and Aida had enjoyed, but held his tongue. This cop's fuse was lit. He was angry as hell, and Jack wasn't giving him what he was looking for. But then again, he was a little prick. Jack shot a glance at Aida, trying to lighten the moment.
You can tell him we ate at a great restaurant.
Aida frowned, but translated it anyway. The short cop suddenly got in Aida's face, shouting,
Gdeya sute yebene rakete?
Aida startled and answered,
Rakete? Nemam poema ochemu gavorish.
Whack! The cop backhanded Aida across the mouth. She whimpered and clutched her face with her hands.
Hey!
Jack lunged toward Aida to block another strike, but the two cops next to him each grabbed him hard by his shoulders and yanked him back, shoving their pistols in his face. The little cop grabbed a fistful of Aida's hair in his hand and pulled her close, sticking his pistol in her face. In his anger, he slipped from Bosnian to the English he had been trying to conceal.
I will only ask you one more time, you Muslim bitch. Where are those...
Behind them, a horn blared, stuttering and loud. The two cops next to Jack turned around with him still in their grip and saw a cloud of dust billowing on the hill road toward them as another Happy Times tour van came careening down at full speed. Jack saw Emir at the wheel, pounding the horn with one hand and steering the van straight toward Jack and the two cops with the other. The two cops raised their pistols to fire. Jack launched both fists up and back, smashing each cop in the face with the back of his hands. They each got off shots, but the shock of the blows caused them to miss. The blows also loosened their grips on Jack just enough for him to fire his right elbow high into the tall cop's jaw with a sickening crack. The man dropped his pistol in the dirt and let go of Jack's collar as he reached for his broken jaw. As soon as Jack's elbow struck the tall cop, he twisted right, driving the heel of his right hand into the car cop's temple, stunning him. Jack Rabbit punched him again with a closed fist just behind the ear until the man and his weapon fell to the ground, as Emir skidded to a stop in a flurry of choking dust. The short cop knelt in the dirt in front of Aida, clutching his ball sack, blood trickling out of his nose. Aida pointed the gun at him. She was breathing heavily, but her hands were steady. Jack turned in time to see the tall cop lunging for his weapon. Jack kicked his face like a soccer ball. The man's head snapped back. Knocked out cold, he collapsed in the dirt. Without hesitating, Jack turned and launched another brutal kick at the other cop, who was reaching for his own weapon in the dirt. He wasn't as lucky as his friend. Jack's foot cracked the cartilage in the man's nose and broke his top front teeth. The man shrieked in pain and clutched his mouth, blood gushing between his fingers. Emir grabbed both pistols out of the dirt and stepped over to Aida.
Are you okay?
Yes, of course. I'm fine.
Me too. Thanks for asking, Jack said, pulling the MP5 off the tall cop and retrieving his passport from the man's pocket. Who are these jokers?
Serb Mafia, Aida said, trying to steal the medical supplies.
She spat at the kneeling cop.
Pigs.
Jack patted down the unconscious cop.
This guy doesn't have any identity papers.
Emir pointed at the other downed officer.
Neither does this one.
Aida barked a command at the short officer, who shook his head.
None of these assholes do, she said.
Believe me, they're not cops. We should call the real cops, Jack said. Aida shook her head, her eyes still sighting down the barrel of the gun toward the short cop, now glowering at her.
We can't.
Why not? She shot him a confused look.
What if the police impound my van? I can't risk it.
The medical supplies, Jack remembered. Crap. Smuggled in illegally, but desperately needed by the clinic.
What do we do with these guys, then?
We can't just let them go. He noticed Aida still hadn't lowered her weapon, and Emir still held two loaded pistols in his hands. And we sure as hell can't shoot them.
I have an idea, Emir said, shoving the pistols into his waistband.
You and Jack go on ahead and I'll follow. In 10 minutes, I'll pull over and call the police. We don't want to be here when anybody shows up.
He looked at Jack.
Okay?
Okay.
Aida added, get some rope and some duct tape. We don't want them leaving before the police arrive.
I'll take care of everything, Emir said.
But call an ambulance too, Jack said. They're gonna need it.
Chapter 51.
Why was Emir following us? Jack asked. He drove the van. Aida was still shaking from the encounter. She lit a cigarette to calm her nerves. It was the first time Jack had seen her smoke.
I don't know. I told him to stay away.
So why didn't he?
He's in love with me. Has been since we were kids.
I hope he didn't see. She waved a hand dismissively.
I don't want to think about it.
She took another drag. So who was that guy in the photo?
Brkic, Jack asked.
He's family. He married one of my mother's cousins years ago. As a favor, I use him to work on my vehicles sometimes.
And what was the cop asking you about? He was pretty pissed off. Aida shook her head.
He wanted to know why we had not paid our protection money.
Did you owe him protection money? Aida blew out a cloud of blue smoke, ignoring the question. The open window whisked it away.
You know they were going to kill us.
She flicked the butt out the window.
Fucking Serbs.
She turned to Jack. Her eyes were wet. She put her hands to her face.
I was so scared.
Jack's cage got rattled, too. He was deathly allergic to lead, especially the kind thrown at him at high velocity. He laid a hand on her head and stroked her thick hair.
It's okay now. You're safe.
She glanced up through her tears.
Am I?
Sure.
Why not?
You frightened me, Jack.
She pulled her knees up to her chin and wrapped her arms around her legs.
Why?
I saw what you did to those men. What kind of financial analyst knows how to fight like that?
I've been training in martial arts for a long time.
Bullshit, Jack. The way you handled yourself?
No.
What you did back there you don't learn in judo classes. You've done this before, haven't you?
I just wanted to protect you.
Who are you, Jack?
I'm just a guy who can throw a punch.
She sighed, turned her face toward her window, and closed her eyes. They rode along in silence the rest of the way, Jack following the prompts of the GPS tracker. He kept running the day's events over in his mind. He wished he spoke the language. There were a few English cognates, for sure, but they spoke so fast he could hardly pick out the words. Drugs? Guns? Money? He just didn't know. The only word he thought he heard clearly was rakete. He supposed it must have meant racket, like mafia rackets. Whatever it was, that Serb mafia cop was sure pissed about it. Emir pulled over 20 minutes later, after tying up the fake cops and shutting their mouths with duct tape. He picked up the phone and dialed a number, but not for an ambulance. "Why are you calling me?" Perkic asked. "We have a problem." Emir explained the situation. "I'll take care of it. You make sure you keep an eye on Aida. There's something else you need to know." "What?" Emir told the Chechen about that fucking kafir American and his shameful use of Aida. But he added, "The American is leaving soon. The sooner the better. For Aida's sake. And yours." Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Aida had fallen asleep for the last hour of the trip, but woke up when they hit massive traffic on the outskirts of town. She yawned and stretched, and glanced at Jack with a smile, brushing her tousled hair out of her eyes like a girl who had been dreaming pleasant dreams. But her smile dimmed as she suddenly remembered what had happened earlier. Jack could see the gears grinding behind her eyes. Jack pointed at the GPS. Traffic lines were red everywhere. "What's going on?" "These are Serbs coming in for the Orthodox renewal service day after tomorrow."
"Yeah, I heard about that. Is it some kind of religious revival?"
Aida shook her head. "It's all just politics, believe me." Jack noticed quite a few national license plates from Serbia in the traffic mix.
"I'm sorry for what happened to us back there, Jack."
"It's not your fault."
"Of course it is. I shouldn't have brought you with me on this run. I wouldn't have traded it for anything."
"And I'm sorry for what I said." She reached out and touched his arm.
"I'm not scared of you. I know you'd never do anything to hurt me. I know you would always protect me."
"Yeah, I would. I'm kind of sweet on you." That made her smile. Jack hated to ruin that smile, but he had to clear the air.
"You did pretty well with that cop today, taking him down and stealing his gun."
"I just kicked the guy in the nuts. Not exactly Bruce Lee stuff like you were doing."
"You handled his pistol like a pro."
Aida shrugged. "My father taught me how to use one when I was very young. He said he never wanted me to be a victim."
"Then he taught you well." "I wonder who taught him."
"Guns don't scare me, Jack. People do."
"Could you have pulled the trigger?"
"I protect the people I love."
Jack turned toward her. That four-letter word caught his attention. She smiled impishly.
"And I protect the people I'm sweet on, too."
Jack followed the GPS onto the narrow street where his apartment was located.
"So, what's the plan for tonight?
Heck, I might even be able to bust out a dance move or two if there's a club you like."
"I'm sorry. I can't do anything tonight.
But I'm leaving soon."
"Don't remind me."
"Did I do something wrong?"
She reached up and touched his troubled face.
"No, my love. I'm the one who has failed you. I never should have opened up my heart to you. You have your life back in America, and I have my life here in Bosnia. It was a beautiful, spontaneous fling. But it's over now, isn't it?"
"A fling?
What else would you call it?"
Jack shrugged.
"I don't know. Were you planning on staying here forever?"
Jack shook his head.
She was right.
But he said, "You can come to the States with me."
He didn't pretend to make a play about fundraising.
"That's very thoughtful of you. But I have my work here.
Work that almost got you killed today."
"It's nothing new.
Someday things will get better for us."
"What if they don't?"
"Then they don't."
"I don't want you to get hurt.
How can you stop it?
Can I at least see you tomorrow?
She shook her head.
I'm sorry, but I can't. A new group of refugees are arriving tomorrow. I need to be at the center.
Then I'll come too.
That's not possible. This group is Syrian. They don't trust Westerners.